Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. This is our first day for a meeting in our regular session, so we've got a few things that we're going to need to kind of clarify and go over. First of all, as the chair, I'll tell you that it's an old dog learning a new trick. You can see I have a laptop in front of me. I don't know if it's going to work, but I told staff I'd try. But first, real quickly, why don't we go through and just do a quick introduction of each other. As Senator for District 4, I represent parts of Lane and Douglas counties, and it's my honor and privilege to be able to chair this committee. And we'll go to my left, audience's right, with Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Chair Prasansky. My name is Doug Whitsett. I represent District 28, which includes all of Klamath, Lake, and Cook counties, parts of Deschutes and the eastern part of Jackson County. Been on the Judiciary Committee for several years, and actually I'm a retired veterinarian.
Good morning. Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is just south of Floyd, but goes clear to the coast and down to the California border, and served on Judiciary 2 sessions ago, and I'm glad to be back.
Welcome aboard.
I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is in Washington and Multnomah counties. This is my third session on Judiciary, once in the House, and my second Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jackie Dingfelder. I'm the state senator in Northeast and Southeast Portland, District 23. This is also my third time serving on Judiciary, once in the House and twice in the Senate, and it's a pleasure to be back.
Well, thank you very much. So what we're going to be doing today is we're looking at the agenda. The first thing we have listed here is possible measures for introduction. This is kind of a continuation for those who are in the listening audience. Judiciary has traditionally been a committee that will allow for bills to be received and introduced as committee bills. This is a process that we use to allow for bills to get into the system. The vote that we usually receive from is an affirmative vote from the members. I want to make certain everyone understands that if a person is voting to support the introduction of a bill through this committee, they are not supporting the bill per se. What they are doing is they're supporting the process to allow the bill to go into the system and to be heard on its merits. There's no guarantee that the bill itself will even be assigned to the Judiciary Committee, but it is a means of a mechanism to allow for bills that need to be introduced to come into the process and allow for those individuals, groups, or organizations that are supporting the bill to have their opportunity to have the bill become before the state legislature. So with that, I'm going to ask one of our councils, in fact, I should say we have two of our councils here today. Cheyenne Ross is going to be leading off. Then over to my right is Bill Taylor, the godfather of all judiciary. And then we have Aaron, is it Dietz?
It's Aaron Knott.
Aaron Knott, I apologize. And Aaron's going to be our third council that we'll be having with us. And so you'll be seeing kind of a musical chairs with the council because they will be working the bills. And so we'll see all or some of them each time that we meet. With that, let's go ahead and maybe go through what the possible bills for introduction are. And I'm going to ask, Cheyenne to go through those, but I guess to be official, as she says, we'll open up a work session for the possible measure introductions. And Council, if you could just tell us what they are.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, for introduction today, it appears we have LC 2921. LC 3317, LC 3334, LC 3516, LC 3517,
and 18.
And LC 3518, thanks, Senator.
All right, so those are the LCs that we have for possible introduction. The chair will take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 2921 dated 12/16/10, LC 3317 dated 1/12/24/11, LC 3334 dated 1-21-11, LC 3516 dated 1-19-11, LC 3517 dated 1-19-11, and LC 3518 dated 1-19-11 be introduced as committee bills.
Committee, we have a motion from Senator Cruz to for introduction of the following LCs: 2921, 3317, 3334, 3516, 3517, and 3518. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Thank you very much. And at this point, what we're going to do, we have a few other bills that are scheduled for a hearing, and one of them is scheduled for a hearing and possible work session, because that one is probably the most straightforward one. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 353. Council, if you can give us a short narrative of what 353 is.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 353 is the this regular session, 2011, revisers bill. It's also referred to as a Scrivener's bill. It corrects grammar and punctuation errors in statute. It deletes obsolete references. It conforms language to existing statutes and legislative style. And it's, thank you. Such a measure is introduced every session from the Office of Legislative Counsel. And Mr. Rutlinger, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, he'll correct me. Chief Editor from Legislative Council is here to provide a brief background.
Ted, thank you for being here. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for having me. I'm Ted Rutlinger from the Legislative Council's office. Senate Bill 353 is our revisers bill. It's a routine bill that's introduced every session. As Ms. Ross described, it corrects errors and references. We remove obsolete provisions, and we conform provisions to the legislative form and style, which you adopt by rule in the form and style manual. The other main goal of this bill is not to make any substantive changes to the law. As you can see in Section 1, there's a section that's been amended every session since 1985, which says specifically that it's the policy of the legislature in this bill to not alter the legislative intent or purposes of the statutory sections that are amended in this bill. In other words, this is simply to correct errors. It's not to change any substantive policy. Second, the title to the bill is Correction of Erroneous Material in Oregon Law. That title would not accept amendments to law that make substantive policy changes. And finally, unlike most bills, following each section in this bill is a note that tells you exactly what it is that we intended to fix in each section. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm off to a really bad start in this committee because I read the whole bill. That was a joke. And Ted, my question is, I told you on Section 17, the abolishment of the Near Shore Resources Fund, and I realized that the task force does sunset. My real concern is that it is transferring any money in that fund to the general fund at a time when we have legislation that will be coming forward to kind of codify what we've done in marine reserves, and we're also looking for various ways to create funding streams for marine reserve research. It would seem to me that if there's money in this account, that would be the place it should go rather than general fund. And right. And so that's my only concern with the bill is that maybe we're taking money that should go to one purpose and just throwing it to the wind.
Before you respond, let's go ahead and just for the record, for those who are following, I know you said Section 17.
Yes.
If you can give us the page number and lines.
Page 22, lines 23 through 30.
All right, thank you. Ted?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, what's happening in Section 17
is, as you described, there was a bill, which was House Bill 3106 last session, which established the Task Force on Nearshore Research. And That task force, as you know, sunsets on July 2nd, 2012. Typically, one of the things that's happening in the last session or two since the financial picture of the state has declined is that these task force bills contain language that sets up a new fund that's separate and distinct from the general fund that allows people to make contributions to the fund in order to pay for the costs of the task force. That's a relatively new provision in Oregon law. Typically, the costs of the task force have been borne by the state agencies over the years. So, in this case, when we draft a task force bill that has a new account like that, that's designed to take in contributions, we also sunset the account on the same day as the task force and send any money that might be in that fund to the general fund just as a matter of routine law. That's the way that we do it. And the reason is that since this account, this new fund, is separate and distinct from the general fund, it is continuously appropriated only to this task force to pay only for the purposes of the task force. And so, logically, when the task force disappears, there is no entity to which the money is continuously appropriated, and that's why we, as a matter of routine drafting, sunset both the task force and the account at the same time. That's what we were attempting to fix here. We simply forgot to put the sunset on the account when we drafted House Bill 3106 in 2009. If the legislature desired any money that might be left over in that account to go someplace else, the legislature is certainly free to make that decision, but you would have to do that by law in a separate bill, because this language continuously appropriates the money to the task force, which is going to go away.
I guess, Mr. Chair, part of my problem in general on something like this is because if we create a task force with a sub-account for some specific purpose and contributions are coming in for that specific purpose, those contributions are meant for that, and for us to arbitrarily reassign that to the general fund kind of breaks the faith with those who make contributions. Like I say, I don't have a problem with the rest of the bill. I just... We have been working very, very hard and very diligently on issues relative to the ocean, and finding the resources to fund the research we need is very difficult. And I'm just not comfortable with this at this point.
Mr. Chair?
Hang on 1 second, please. So let me just make sure for the record, what we're doing here is basically trying to clarify an omission that was made last session, that the other bill that you made reference to would have and should have had this language included.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
All right. Senator Dingfelder.
Well, I was just going to address Senator Cruz's concerns, and I certainly understand the concerns and have been working very closely with the members of the Coastal Caucus on this issue. We are actually hearing on Thursday in the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee an update on marine reserves and what's going on with that. I don't know if there's been discussions with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Service, because I do know there are attempts right now to look at additional funding, and I'm not sure where that money would go. And maybe, I don't know if we have to move on this bill today, maybe we can get clarification on that and come back and see if either... Then we can introduce another bill that addresses Senator Cruz's concerns to make sure that that money is going somewhere, or figure out if we can change the sunset date on this.
I understand that, but my prerogative and position on this is that we've already made a decision 2 years ago as to what we're going to do with these accounts, and now what we're looking at is potentially taking a particular type of account for a particular reason and treat it differently than what we've done already. It seems to me the policy was set, and what this bill is attempting to do, and that's why I wanted clarification before we went there, was to just fix what had been left out in the original bill. And it seems to me there's a larger policy question and issue that may need to be had regarding any and all of these sub-accounts, not just one.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, I am personally ready to move the bill forward based on the clarification we've gotten from council as to what it does. we may not, and if we want to have that discussion regarding the policy, then I would say let's have that discussion with all of the sub-accounts through the process and put it into a bill that's going to address what's going to be uniformly, unless we are going to have, a review or do something retrospectively to determine which sub-accounts we think now, today, should stay in place for those possible uses as compared to others that should default back into the general fund when the task force has completed its work.
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarification in regards to Senator Cruz's concern. So this was targeted specifically for funding the task force. So what I am hearing and my understanding is that additional work, I guess what we need to find out, and I'm happy to work with Senator Cruz, is to find out if we do get additional funding that's outside of the task force, where that would go, and would it be in a separate account versus in the general fund? And because this was specifically, what I'm recalling now, was just to fund the work of the task force, and now we're talking about an implementation, is my understanding.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, true. But the chair did speak to a bigger issue. Is if we set up an account for a purpose and people contribute for that purpose and then the money goes elsewhere, is that keeping faith? It is a bigger question. I would submit that we may have made a policy decision 2 years ago, but that doesn't mean necessarily it was the right one. My whole purpose in bringing this up as a member of the Coastal Caucus is we weigh in on these issues, and I have not gotten a read from that group as to their comfort level with this.
Thank you, Chair Prasansky. Mr. Rettlinger, do you know how much money is in the fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I do not, but we could find out.
This would be critical, Mr. Chair, for me to know, because I'm also as a member of the Coastal Caucus, it would be critical for me to know what's so much how before I would be able to support this.
Well, I have no problem knowing what it is, but I think we're missing the point. What I understood the point here is that this actually sets up a mechanism for people to fund the work of the task force. It's not to take the money and then use it in some particular way besides funding the operation of the task force. And the chair is more than willing to put this off for a day to allow for that to for members to get more information. But I mean, this is pretty straightforward, guys. I mean, basically, it's are we or are we not going to have a means and mechanism that once the task force completes its work to then have that money revert back into the general fund? And that's what the policy is. It's not how much money's there. The question really is the money, once it's the task force is dissolved, then are we just going to let this money just sit in the sub-account? Because there's no authority for that money to be used in any other way.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to argue that point. That's absolutely true. But my thought is when you're setting up a task force like this and setting up a sub-account, to fund it, maybe we need to be a little more deliberative on the back end as to be more directive in what happens to the money rather than general fund. And at this point, it's quite simply if it's an empty shell, that's one thing. But when we're scrambling for dollars for ocean research, once this goes back to general fund, it's gone. And I mean, I just need some answers.
Mr. Chair, if I may interrupt, Senator Cruz, for the record, for what it's worth, we have received no fiscal impact and no revenue impact statements on this measure.
Well, that doesn't mean there isn't money there, though.
Yeah. Well, no, the reality, we're going to go ahead and put this bill over till tomorrow for continuation, so I want to make sure it's noted for a work session. The reality, from my perspective on this, is that basically, all we're trying to do is have a means for whatever money, if any money, is actually still in the account that was set up and established for the purpose of the operation of the task force, is to revert back so it doesn't sit in some sub-account if you want to have the discussion of what if there is any money in this type of account in the future, then it seems to me that that's something that should be a bigger policy issue, and I would say should be at Ways and Means, not Judiciary. So any other questions for the council?
Good point.
Any other questions for council? All right, thank you very much. And this will be on for work session tomorrow. Close the work session on Senate Bill 353. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearings now. We're going to start with, unless council tells me differently, Senate Bill 75.
Chairman, Committee Senate Bill 75 and the rest of the bills before you come from the Oregon Department of Corrections. Senate Bill 75 makes permanent provision that allows placing an offender in post-prison supervision on inactive status. Takes effect upon the passage. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may remember this bill. This issue from last session, this simply removes the sunset.
And let's see, is it Mark?
Kadat.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As council has stated, Senate Bill 75 seeks to eliminate the sunset clause associated with Section 23 of House Bill 3508. And Section 23 of House Bill 3508 allowed for what we call local control offenders, or those offenders sentenced to 12 months or less, to move to an inactive status based upon their compliance and certain other criteria. This aligns the practice with the parole board cases, who currently are allowed to move to inactive status as well. The department, as well as the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, feels that in addition to a cost savings, this is also good correctional practice, and asks that the sunset clause be removed and that this practice be permanently adopted.
Thank you. Question, Senator Wissa.
Thank you, Chair Podansky. Mark, Section 47, sub 2, Section 21 and 24, Chapter 660, Oregon Laws 2009 are repealed. Section 31, Chapter 660, Oregon Laws 209 are repealed, and so forth. Now look those up. They have to do with mess sentencing for possession, sentence for manufacturing with addictive treatment, requirement for completion of sentences, 50% probation reduction, aggravated theft ID, and so forth. I think this committee needs to look a little more closely at exactly what we are repealing here, and that when we go back a couple of years, we had some real unintended consequences in some of the things that we created and repealed, and I think that we need to understand directly what these things are that we're repealing. So could you clarify that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, those repeal dates are taken from House Bill 3508. So the only thing Senate Bill 75 seeks to do is eliminate one of the sunset clause that relate to the local control post-prison supervision. The other repeal dates outlined in Section 1 of the bill are already contained in House Bill 3508.
And House Bill 3508 was one of the most misunderstood bills probably ever came through this building. So my point is, what are we repealing? What are we repealing? What are we adding? Repealing the sunset on? What are we actually doing here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, we are repealing the section of House Bill 3508 that states that the status of local control offenders to move to inactive status for crimes committed before July 1st, 2011. So we're repealing that it applies to those crimes committed before July 1st, 2011. So we're removing that section, and it will continue to apply to all crimes committed on or after that date.
When we, as I recall, we sort of had a graph where this was in effect, and then it's not in effect, and then it's in effect, and then it's not in effect. How does that change that graph? I mean, are we?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, bill. Senator, I had to call legislative counsel's office when I read this bill. Okay, it's a difficult bill to follow. What it does is, as Mark said, it removes the sunset provision from 3508 as it relates, so it now means Section 21 and Section 23 are now active. They're now, they will be in permanent law. Let me read Section 21. Each person convicted of a felony and sentenced to probation of the rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission is eligible for reduction of period of active probation. For compliance with the conditions of probation, the person's supervision plan is defined by the rules of the Department of Corrections. Section 23 is similar. So what you have up here, two other provisions, it says these provisions sunset as of the particular date, which I believe is the end of this fiscal year. We remove that for this bill, and that then gets you Sections 21 and Section 23. I had the diagram.
So in other words, they stay in effect. They don't sunset.
Yeah, they don't go away.
And so that allows for the control and oversight at the local level. Where it would have gone back, reverted.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the policy behind this is that it gives the parole and probation officer the ability to reward good behavior. It also goes to the fact that research shows that someone who's been on probation or parole and is abiding by the terms and conditions after they've gone a certain period of time, they're not likely to break those terms and conditions. It gives the parole and probation departments opportunities to basically say, well, we're not going to have to spend too much resources on this person. We can spend more resources on someone else. It's a triage. It allows them to triage.
Bill, if, for instance, if the if you have someone who is currently sentenced for the possession of meth or distribution of meth, manufacture of meth, sale of meth within 1,000 feet of a school, would this, what we're doing here, would this allow for these people to be released to community corrections at an earlier time and supervised in the community as opposed to being, will have that any effect on that whatsoever?
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I do not believe so. They could be under the local control population. And my assumption is, and Mark can address this better than I can, if that person is, you know, has gone for a year with clean urines and has passed polygraph tests and everything else, and has got a job and everything's fine at home, it would give the probation and parole officers to say, hey, look at, okay, the last 6 months or last year, you don't have to report it as often. You're in inactive supervision. Just stay in touch with me, things like that. Mark, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt. Just to clarify, the offender in your scenario would still serve their sentence. This would apply strictly to their period of supervision. So once they're out in the community after having served their sentence, they would have the ability, like counsel said, if they meet certain criteria, to move to a lesser form of supervision, which we refer to as inactive status.
And Mark, that decision is made by the probation officer, not the individual, correct?
That's correct, Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 75? Not seeing, hearing, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 75, and we're going to open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 76.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 76 once again comes here from the Department of Corrections, includes from the definition of corrections officer a person employed full-time in the Department of Corrections, a county jail, and the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training has certified and who has supervisory and management responsibility.
All right, and I have, I believe, two people that have signed up. Is it Michael Glauer and then Marilyn Lawrence? All right, y'all would come forward, please. And we're not going to do 77 next. We're going to jump in and do 77 next. Good morning. Whoever wants to get started, if you would just identify yourself, and that would be great.
Good morning, Chair Mazansky and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for the Department of Corrections, the Assistant Director of Operations for the Department of Corrections. I'm here this morning to testify in support of Senate Bill 76. What we're asking in this bill is to expand the definition of a corrections officer for the purpose of maintaining their certification to include officers that supervise or have managerial responsibilities over corrections officers. presently in ORS 181.610, the definition of corrections officer, you have to have primary perform the duties in custody and control of supervision of our inmates. So basically what that means that when you come in at the ground level as an officer and you, receive your certification, as you go up through the ranks in our department up to captain, you're able to maintain your certification. If you do decide to promote higher than captain to assistant superintendent, or in my position as the assistant director or even as a deputy director, the current language for that definition, you would be penalized and you would lose your certification. Your certification would lapse. So we're asking for a change in the definition so that the folks that do decide to promote in our agency, as well as I think in our county partners and city municipalities, they would be able to maintain their certification that they've worked hard for. There is no fiscal impact in reference to this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And I don't have much to add to what Mr. Gower has already placed on the record. That is what the bill does. It makes the changes in our department's definitions of a corrections officer. It does apply statewide. The Department of Corrections is a great example of a larger corrections agency that is most limited by the current definition of a corrections officer, because only those individuals who have direct supervision of inmates currently meet the definition of a corrections officer. And so as they promote in a large agency, particularly for the Department of Corrections, but we believe there is also an indirect impact to other large corrections facilities within the state, those individuals no longer meet the definition for purposes of their Department of Public Safety Standards and Training certifications.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Mr. Gower, we talked about this on the telephone, but if this were adopted, would it change the collective bargaining process in any way to include these lieutenants and captains in the represented collective bargaining unit?
Myself, I'd like to defer to Ms. Lawrence. We did have a discussion in reference to the conversation we had on the phone the other day, Senator Wissett, and we spoke to our counsel at DOJ and also had conversation with DPSST. So if I could, I'd like to defer to Ms. Lawrence.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Whitsitt, the initial assessment of our department is that there should not be an impact from a statewide perspective. Our department's definitions identify who is eligible to obtain or retain a statewide license. They do not impact employment classifications or position descriptions, but only who within an agency who has already been identified for a particular position would meet the definition for basically the professional credential that our department issues. But we agree with the Department of Corrections that this is an important issue, and we want to ensure that there are no unintended consequences. Yesterday, I contacted our legal counsel, and I believe the Department of Corrections has also contacted theirs, and we'd like their timely analysis to be able to give you a definitive answer.
Time, you don't have a yes or no answer for the question.
Correct.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Chairman of the Committee, when do you expect that answer from counsel?
Chair Brzezinski and Mr. Taylor, we have asked for an answer within a couple of days if we can get it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 76? Not seeing any. We're going to close the public hearing on 76. I'm going to open up a public hearing on, we're going to skip 77. We're going to come back to it today. I'm going to go ahead and open up one for Senate Bill 78. But because 77 has probably a little more detailed information that we're going to need, I want to hold that off until we finish these others. So, Senate Bill 78, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 78, once again, comes to you from the Department of Corrections, allows the Department of Corrections and Board of Parole and Post-Person Supervision to release early terminally ill inmates who are not otherwise eligible for release, exclude inmates found guilty of aggravated murder or murder. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this there is a companion member in our committee, this SJR3, that would probably have to be passed. I think the interesting thing about this bill is if part of it would require a two-thirds vote and the other part would require a constitutional amendment. One, the constitutional amendment as it relates to sentences passed in open court, and the two-thirds vote as it would relate to people sentenced after the effective date.
Okay. I had two people that are signed up on the registration. Bill, is it Hofer? Or Hofel?
Hapel.
All right. If you'll please come forward, and then Gil Meyer.
Chair Krasanski, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Bill Hafel. I'm the Health Services Administrator for Oregon Department of Corrections. What this bill would do is enable the Department of Corrections and the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to consider additional inmates for medical parole. Inmates who are serving mandatory minimum sentences are currently precluded from consideration. This would allow the Board to advance the release date of inmates sentenced for crime, as Counsel Taylor said, other than murder or aggravated murder. To be considered for medical parole, the inmate has to have demonstrated an extended course of conduct indicating outstanding reformation, suffer from a severe medical condition, including terminal illness, and then elderly or permanently incapacitated in such a manner that they are unable to move to place from place to place without assistance. Currently, DOC houses about 14,000 inmates across the state, and we continue to face issues with medically fragile and aging population. We don't anticipate a large number of inmates would be impacted by this in consideration and being released. In 2008, there were three inmates released by the board, three inmates in 2009, and none in 2010. One of the things that we do in the case planning and release planning is make sure that appropriate housing is one of the considerations prior to release, and we wouldn't recommend release without appropriate housing or care facility in place to release and care for the inmate. Primarily, this would be done through, we have a person that coordinates this activity to ensure that the inmate's continuity of care is maintained as they go out to the community. And just, there's three examples in the written testimony. The three folks, one from 2008, two from 2009, just representative. Basically, the longest any of them survived was about 30 days once they were released.
Thank you for putting that on the record. Gail?
Thank you. Gail Meyer, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We're very much in support of the bill. I'm only here just to flag that there, I have a few members who are concerned that there might be an unintended consequence. The language of the bill, by disallowing certain procedures for murder and aggravated murder, may impact a case that was just decided 2 months ago by the Supreme Court addressing murder parole hearings. And so I just simply wanted to flag to the committee that I have members working on this diligently, trying to figure out what really, if there is a problem or if there isn't. But those, the opinion that was issued 2 months ago didn't have anything to do with compassionate leave. It had everything to do with murder parole hearings, but we just want to make sure that there's not an unintended consequence, and we'll work diligently and work with counsel, but we do support the bill.
Okay. Before we take questions, clarification, Gail. What I understand is those two categories, aggregate murder and murder, would not even be considered, so I'm not sure how that would factor into a parole hearing.
Thank you. Senator Przanski, I would agree, but there's language in the bill that would disallow their release or request for early reduction at any time, and there are statutes that do allow someone currently serving sentences less than death, so life, to request a what's called a murder rehabilitation parole hearing. So I'm not convinced, to be honest with you, Senator, that there is a problem, because the underlying statute has changed from what's at issue and appeal there versus the way it reads now. So we have the appellate lawyers looking at it, and if there's a problem, we're motivated to quickly find a fix. And we do support the bill, though.
All right. Other questions?
Congressman, or what's that?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. I understand what you're trying to do. I think it's a great idea, and I think how you're applying it currently makes perfect sense. My concern is in statute and also in the SJR 3, the permanent incapacitation or severely ill is not defined. And that leaves it open for other interpretation other than how you might interpret it at a later time by other folks. And I think that, for instance, you could have a serial rapist who was in undergoing severe symptoms and degenerative symptoms of AIDS to be released from prison. I mean, just, I'm just taking it off the top of my head. Those are the kind of things that I'm a little concerned about, and I think that the definition of a permanent incapacitation severely ill would make a perfect sense in this case.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt. So if I could, there's criteria and a process we use under which inmates are brought forward and considered beyond just what's listed in the statute. And that actually goes through a committee, which is the chief medical officer with the Department of Corrections, my boss, Mike Gower, who was here previously, and the superintendent of the facility where the inmate is housed. It goes from there, it goes to the director for review and recommendation, and from there then goes to the parole board. We're very judicious about the use of this, as evidenced by only three people. There's no intent by the department to release anybody that would be capable of injuring someone. That they are, the inmates who've been released have all been terminal, and the only other consideration of the incapacitated piece of that says that they're unable to move from place to place without assistance. Mm-hmm. So that would be, for example, somebody that may have sustained an injury that might be a quadriplegic that's unable to move about and needs assistance with daily living.
A couple questions. One is, are the criteria inclusive? So, I mean, it's not just one or the other, but it's, you have to be all of these things. You have to be severely ill, terminally ill, non-ambulatory. All those things are individually. And secondly, I understand and I applaud how you're doing it now. I'm just concerned that if you put it in statute with the as an undefined entity, that your successor or the next director or somebody who is deeply in trouble financially in the Department of Corrections may change that and just follow the letter of the law.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, this is essentially a parole board statute, and we've worked with them on this language, and I wouldn't presume to change what they have in place. We'd be happy to go back and have that conversation with them.
Any other questions?
And just, Mr. Chair, just comment. The first thing that popped into my mind with this was the terminally ill terrorist in England that got released and suddenly got very healthy. you know, terminally ill is, I mean, we're all terminally ill, we're all going to die. So, you know.
Speak for yourself.
No,
but not terminally ill.
Well, I mean, you know, that's something that somebody's going to pop up at some point in time in this is, you know, they went through all of that rigmarole for that guy who was terminally ill and on the verge of death, and they released him. He went back home, and suddenly he was fine again.
Lockerbie bomber.
Yeah. So, I mean, I understand. I support what you're after here. To have a quadriplegic still in prison is, it doesn't make any sense on any level I can think of. But just a caution. So,
all right. The only other question I had for clarification, and this is probably for Gail, for your research that's being done, it appears to me that currently a person who is serving a sentence for murder or aggravated murder is not even eligible for asking for one of these murder parole hearings based on their medical condition. And if that's the case, it seems to me that it's moot as to any concerns as to what the court did 2 months ago. But let's make sure that's brought out as well. Anything else for the witnesses? Counsel.
Here, if I remember correctly, a person who's in the Department of Corrections is not eligible for federal medical benefits. Is that correct?
Correct.
And when they are released from the Department of Corrections, say to go to a hospice or something like that, they are eligible. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Mr. Taylor, I didn't catch that.
Sure. And when they are released, say someone who's terminally ill who's released from the Department of Corrections and say that, for example, they go to a hospice, they would now be eligible to receive federal benefits, health benefits?
Yes.
Thank you.
Depends on where they're released to, but yes.
If there's no other questions, comments, thank you very much. Was anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 78? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 78. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 423.
Chairman of the Committee, Senate Bill 423 comes to you from the Oregon Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority. Allows the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority to certify pursuant to rule employees to provide mental health services to inmates. Chair members of the committee, a bill that was passed last session has caused some problems as it relates to the certification of people that have been giving mental health services to both agencies for some period of time. That's why the bill's here.
All right. We have Jenna Russell and Colette Peters scheduled to testify.
Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Jana Russell. I'm the Administrator for Behavioral Health Services.
Ms. Russell, before you continue, could you take your microphone and bring it down a little bit just to make sure we get you recorded. Thank you.
I just want
to make sure. There you go.
My name is Jana Russell. I'm the Administrator for Behavioral Health Services for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 423. Senate Bill 423 will allow the Oregon Youth Authority and Oregon Department of Corrections to continue to provide the constitutionally mandated mental health treatment for youth and offenders. Senate Bill 423 intends to repair an unintended consequence to Senate Bill 177, which limited the provision of mental health services to those who are licensed by the Board of Social Workers. This was an unintended consequence for both the Oregon Department of Corrections and Oregon Youth Authority. The bill was not intended to impose these restrictions on Oregon Youth Authority and Department of Corrections. The mental health specialists who are employed by the Youth Authority and Oregon Department of Corrections currently maintain or exceed the requirements for certification based on the community mental health standard for qualified mental health specialist and qualified mental health associate. So all of our employees already meet and exceed the current requirements for delivery of the service. Oregon Department of Corrections houses 14,000 inmates statewide. Of those 14,000 inmates, 50% of the population has a diagnosed mental illness. 24% of the population has what we call severe and persistent mental illness, and those are diagnoses like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, psychotic disorders, and major depression. And again, we're constitutionally mandated to provide services for our inmates and youth. Statewide, Oregon Department of Corrections employs 48 mental health specialists to provide the mental health services for the entire population. Of our 48 mental health specialists, only 13 at this time are licensed under the Board of Social Workers or licensed professional counselors. These are the folks that currently meet the rule under 177 and are available to provide the services for all of the inmates in the state. Since Senate Bill 177 took effect, we have met the rule by limiting our services to crisis prevention and crisis response. And we are able to do that minimally. 13 mental health specialists for the entire state certainly doesn't meet the constitutional mandate or standard of care for services. So we cannot sustain this for very long. Senate Bill 423 will restore our agency's ability to provide the constitutionally mandated services. We have been working on the official certification for all of our staff. They all meet or exceed the qualifications. We will be able to have the temp rule adopted and all of our staff certified within 30 days of passage and signature by the governor. We have a letter that the Department of Corrections and Oregon Youth Authority drafted that will go into the record to the Board of Social Workers that that states that we will be able to accomplish this within 30 days of passage, and it limits this exemption period from the date that Senate Bill 177 took place, January 1st, up until the 30 days when we have our QMHAs, QMHPs certified. There is no fiscal impact if this bill passes. There is both a fiscal impact and a human impact if this bill does not pass. We will then be required, both agencies will be required, to lay off the existing staff that don't have licensed and hire new staff who do have licenses. And there will be a considerable cost difference in what we are paying mental health specialists currently. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Peters.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colette Peters, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning about Senate Bill 423. Ms. Russell has outlined the impact of 423 and the original intent of Senate Bill 177. I've also reiterated that in my written testimony that I've provided to the committee. So in the interest of time, I will not repeat what has already been said, but would like to highlight specifically how this bill would impact the Oregon Youth Authority. This issue is critical for us because of the 33 staff that we have employed as qualified mental health professionals of the Oregon Youth Authority. Only 17 of those are licensed. So Ms. Russell talked about the financial and human impact if this bill is not passed, and that would be true for the individuals of the Oregon Youth Authority as well. The remaining 16 QMHPs would not be able to continue in their positions at the agency where they provide critical mental health services to young offenders. Unlike the Department of Corrections, we have actually continued in agreement with the board to provide the services by our QMHPs as we always have, both the clinical services and the behavioral treatment services that are specific to a correctional setting. But this bill would then get us into compliance with the law. I would also like to highlight that the staff who are hired as QMHPs, like the Department of Corrections, must have high academic credentials in specific areas and really demonstrate competence in assessment, diagnosis, and treatment. In addition to these qualifications, QMHPs are also assessed clinically by supervisors during a probationary period at the Oregon Youth Authority, and they meet the requirements, of course, of the agency. So as you all know, I fully support young offenders in OIA's care being provided with professional mental health services. That is one of the things that we really focus on in the agency, and I am confident that the current QMHPs that we have at the agency are providing that professional mental health services that our kids need. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Great, thank you. Questions? Senator Wissett.
As we spoke on the telephone, I don't believe that it was an unintended consequence, because I believe it was in my amendment to Senate Bill 177 that would require the same standard for folks who work for the state government as people who work in the private sector to provide those services. That was the intent. I understand the fiscal. I think that the OIA is making progress in approaching those goals. I'm somewhat taken aback that apparently the Department of Corrections hasn't done anything for 18 months, or hasn't been done very little for 18 months. It sounds to me from your testimony, unless I missed something, that the Department of Correction has not done a great deal in trying to get these people licensed or get some alternative to licensing over the 18 months since the bill passed. But from my point of view, we should not have a separate set of criteria for a professional to work for the public or to work for the in the private sector, and that was the intent of the amendment to Senate Bill 177. So I will be struggling to support this bill because I don't think it. Certainly it seems the OYA is getting closer to the getting to compliance with the law, but I don't see where the Department of Corrections has made significant progress.
Senator Prezansky, Senator Whitsett, I'd like to answer that question.
Please do.
When we were reviewing Senate Bill 177, we recognized that Department of Corrections uses the same standard of qualification that is required in community mental health. We understood that we would be able to certify our folks as either QMHAs or QMHPs under the existing rules for that certification. Our staff met the standard, and we embarked upon the process to issue the formal certification, and that process includes, it is done by our licensed clinical staff, our licensed clinical social worker, clinical director, and our chief psychiatrist. Reviewed the employment records, the educational records, and the transcripts of all of the mental health specialists employed by the Department of Corrections, and did ascertain that they met the standard, proceeded with that process only to discover in conversations with Department of Human Services that they were unable to certify our staff as well as their staff, that exemption only covered community mental health and not Department of Corrections and OYA. So we did embark on the certification process, and we are ready to actually sign the paperwork and certify our staff in accordance with the community mental health standard for QMHA and QMHP.
Does the Board of Social Workers and the relevant board for counselors, are they on board with you as far as saying that your certification is equal to theirs, and so that the certification for the private sector and the public sector would be the same, and that the people would have the same capabilities under their license?
We do have the support of the Oregon Board of Social Workers in this process.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I think she.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
You may.
Just as a matter of record, in response to Senator Whitsett's question, the certification process internal to OYA and internal to DOC are actually mirrored processes. So I didn't want the senator to think that OYA was. Had a more stringent certification process. It is equal to the Department of Corrections.
Thank you,
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I had this conversation as well. I think what we have here is a set of rules over here and a set of rules over here and a disconnect. And I guess on some level it's comforting to know that government has as much trouble navigating DHS as citizens do. But what it speaks to, and I'm going to be very hard on rules this session, I think, and what I suggested was if you know the standard you want and you can comply with the standard, maybe it should be in statute rather than rule. We as a body leave too many things to rules that we should probably be doing ourselves, and I don't know whether this is one of them or not, but if we know the standard and you're complying with the standard, let's just say what it is and be done with it, then you don't have to go to DHS for anything. But
all right. Any other comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 423?
Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 423. We're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing for the day, Senate Bill 77.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 77 comes to you from the Department of Corrections again, places limits on an inmate's ability to file small claims, prohibits an inmate from bringing small claims against actions against another inmate. Chairman of the committee, Andrea Morris from the ACLU has submitted written testimony. She wanted to appear in opposition to the bill, but is out of town.
I understand we have some handouts that have been given to us. Also, one from Janine Woodford, who's not scheduled to be, but there is opposition filed. And it's quite possible that we will continue this hearing into tomorrow, because I believe Ms. Meyer is supposed to be back by then.
If I could add one thing, Mr. Chairman of the committee, the staff measure summary is done by our law clerk, Drew Johnson. This bill was supposed to be heard tomorrow, but due to the governor having a meeting with all agency heads, we had to flip the agenda, and he cannot be here.
And I understand that. And so, Max, why don't you go ahead and come forward? I have three other people that are scheduled to testify. It looks like two are in opposition and one that's neutral. Paul, is that correct? All right. So if you want anyone else up, if not, go ahead.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Max Williams. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. Here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 77 that was filed by the department. I recognize that this bill has raised concern, particularly by Ms. Myers at ACLU, and I've had a chance to review her testimony and would be happy to carry on this conversation further with the committee and with Ms. Myers. What this bill is not is an attempt by the Department of Corrections to foreclose the rights of inmates to have access to the courts. That is not what this bill is about. What this bill is about the department addressing a number of issues that have continued to plague us over the years with respect to how inmates access particularly certain courts in some cases that pose a problem for us in both the operations of the Department of Corrections and the management of inmate relationships. Senate Bill 77 does a couple of sort of minor things, and then it does one major thing, and I'd like to sort of talk about those a little bit in reverse. First off, this bill tries to clarify the way an inmate can access small claims courts. More frequently than ever, we are seeing the department itself being sued in small claims court by inmates. These suits don't limit themselves necessarily to what you and I might think is a traditional small claims action, but at times are actual suits in small claims challenging either statute, policy, procedure, or in cases even constitutional issues of the Department of Corrections and our authority in a small claims jurisdiction, which is not a court of record. Our lawyers have to actually seek court permission to appear on behalf of the department in small claims for those kinds of cases because, as you know, the statute typically doesn't allow attorneys to represent their clients in a small claims case. And we ask that that be changed, in fact, so that our attorneys can, by a matter of right, appear in small claims when the department is sued there. The other thing we've asked to do with respect to the access to small claims for the inmate population is to leave it focused on the kinds of things that a small claims court is really designed to address, which is property damage. So we've asked for a limitation that when we are sued in small claims for the damage or loss of an inmate's property, that the damage amount be limited to the actual loss of property, that there not be access to pain and suffering damages or other kinds of damages in a small claims action, no injunctive relief or any other behavior. But if we've damaged or broken a person's piece of property and moving them from one cell to another, or if an item become lost, that those issues then get put a price on it, and that that's what we're held to from a damage standpoint. So it's not about denying them access to small claims. It's simply narrowing the scope of the kinds of actions. We don't believe, for example, that in a case where we're being accused perhaps of an inappropriate action that resulted in someone being injured, for example, that ought to be a small claims matter, that matter ought to be actually taken up in a court of record in a circuit court, and that we deal with it in that situation. Secondly, we've asked for some broader time frames. Oftentimes, these small claims cases get filed, and we're given the way the timing in a small claims action works, the notice gets to the institution, it
doesn't go through the normal process of noticing someone in the Attorney General's office, and by the time we are responding, the action has already been set, and in some cases a default judgment's actually been taken. So we've asked also that there be a limitation on access to default judgments in these small claims matters. The third issue with respect to small claims that I want to talk about is that we have also seen an increasing amount of inmates suing other inmates for actions ongoing inside the institution in small claims actions. One case, for example, had an inmate who had provided a non-lawyer inmate, by the way, but what we would call sort of a prison lawyer, who had provided assistance to another inmate in a matter, actually suing that inmate after he had provided services to that inmate in small claims in order to collect his fee for the unlawful legal representation services that he had provided. And because we're not a party to that case, those kinds of cases essentially go through small claims. We typically then become aware of it when we receive a writ of garnishment, garnishing one of the inmate's trust accounts against the other inmate. Our concern about the use of this procedure for extortion and other inappropriate behavior inside the institutions where we're not a party to it can create significant concerns, obviously, from a security and inmate management standpoint. So we've asked that that inmates are not allowed to sue other inmates in a small claims matter, again, a court that isn't a court of record. We've also asked that they not be allowed to sue the Department of Corrections in justice courts. Again, not a court of record, but that those seats be limited to circuit court, to where they have access in circuit court. So those are the issues primarily around this. I could give you some additional stories of where these cases have been used and filed and have created some concern for us, both from an operational standpoint and from an inmate management standpoint. Finally, one of the things that I want to talk about is probably the bigger piece of, I think, where people have some heartburn with this bill, and that's requiring that that prior to being sued, generally, that inmates, prior to suing the Department of Corrections, exhaust their administrative remedies. A number of years ago, the federal government passed the Prison Litigation Reform Act. That act essentially requires an exhaustion of administrative remedies by the inmate before accessing the federal courts. The purpose of that, obviously, because inmates by their nature tend to be quite litigious, was to limit the access of the litigiousness or the non-meritorious cases that were being filed in federal court, and to try to, frankly, resolve matters where inmates have concern at the lowest possible level through a grievance process, and that they must exhaust those administrative grievance processes prior to filing their lawsuit. There are exceptions to this in federal court, and this bill would create an exception in the Oregon system as well to constitutionally protect inmates who are filing cases about serious failures of the department to either protect them or provide appropriate medical care, or serious instances of constitutional violations of confinement, where inmates can immediately bypass all of the grievance process and file a habeas corpus action and actually have court-appointed counsel associated with them on bringing those cases forward. We think that's the healthy and appropriate bypass of the grievance process if it's a serious matter. But on smaller matters, we think it is appropriate that inmates exhaust the grievance process, that they move through that process in such a way as to try to resolve matters at the lowest possible level, and then if still unresolved or unsatisfied with the response they get from the department, that we would then be subject to suit in state court just as we are now. We believe that this is an appropriate balance of the state's resources, an appropriate balance of the department's resources. We have a robust grievance process that allows inmates to resolve issues. We fine-tuned that grievance process since 2005 to actually make it more effective, more secure, and a real tool for solving inmate concerns, and we believe that it's functioning appropriately. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think I've hit most of the points that I wanted to make. I know that I've also got my legal counsel, Mr. Van Volkenberg from the Department of Justice here, if there are any questions specifically about constitutional issues raised by Ms. Myers that you may want addressed. I try really hard to not practice constitutional law as the director of the department because it makes the folks over at the Department of Justice nervous. But if I can answer any of those questions, I'd be happy to do so as well.
All right. Let's see. It looks like we are going to have a few questions. Senator Bonamici. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Director Williams, I'm not going to ask you a constitutional question. I'm going to ask you if you have any data about the numbers of cases, both the inmate versus inmate and the inmate versus Department of Corrections cases.
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, my understanding is from conversations with the folks over at the Department of Justice who are typically handling these cases, that we have anywhere from, I think, 10 to 30 of these kinds of cases ongoing at any one time. So it ebbs and flows, but there's sort of a consistent number that they're sort of always in the system.
Thank you. In the follow-up, in both categories, both the inmate versus inmate and the inmate versus Department of Corrections?
I think we probably have more inmate versus department cases than inmate versus inmate cases, but I imagine at any one point that might actually flip. Typically what we found is we see this sort of slowly sort of expanding as more inmates become aware that this is a tool they can use. We see some expansion. And we see it also treated, obviously, small claims courts aren't universally the same in every county, and we see some situations in counties that seem to let it run more and are a little less responsive to the department's concerns than in others, so it just depends, I think, in counties. We've also had a couple of cases where an inmate has sued another inmate in a county where there wasn't a Department of Corrections institution. There's just a combination of effects, and that's what we're really trying to remedy in this bill.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments? Yes.
Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Williams, maybe this is a question for your counsel. The Oregon Constitution says every man shall have a remedy in due course of law for injury done to him and his person, property, reputation. That's Article 1, Section 10. As you know, Mr. Williams, from your experience here, we oftentimes look to the time of statehood to see whether what right existed at that time. And I had an opportunity briefly to talk to Mr. von Valkenburg, and maybe he could address that.
Jeff, why don't you come on up?
Sure.
Let your legal counsel do your speaking.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Van Valkenburg. I'm General Counsel Contact Attorney in the Department of Justice for the Department of Corrections. Counsel Taylor and I had a conversation as he spoke about just prior to the committee hearing. I just saw the ACLU's Ms. Meyer's letter this morning. She raises this Article 1, Section 10 issue under the Constitution in a fairly vague way without analysis. My understanding is that, as Mr. Taylor said, that the Oregon Supreme Court has construed this provision to require, as part of a two-part analysis, the first question is, was there a right at common law for a remedy for the injury in play? My understanding is that in this state, prison inmates did not have a right to sue civilly for damages at the time of the adoption of the Oregon Constitution. In fact, they were what's known as, in the legal framework here, as being civilly dead. And as a result of that, Article 1, Section 10 really, from my perspective, is not implicated.
I was just telling Senator Cruz, as we had in the other bill, that's like terminally ill. All right, any other questions? Jeff, you are you're on here as being neutral. I don't know if you had any other comments you needed to make or wanted to make.
Chairman, I appreciate that. I'm here in my capacity as contact counsel for the Department of Corrections, not speaking for the Department of Justice or the Attorney General.
All right, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, as we leave the dais, I just want to again reiterate, certainly from my experience as a practicing lawyer and working in the seats that you're all now in now, I have no desire to limit legitimate cases of inmates coming forward through an appropriate process. That's not the desire of the Department of Corrections. It's not our intent here. But we do believe that there is a process by which that we can still provide that right, provide better and adequate approaches, and certainly take the uncertainty of these kinds of cases appearing in
courts, non-courts of record, like justice courts and small claims courts, where we believe the department and, in fact, other inmates often are at an extreme disadvantage. And that's really what we're trying to resolve here. Thank you.
All right. The other two people that were on the schedule is Bruce Miller, and I misspoke, who is in a neutral position, and then Paul Snyder, and then Mary, I got a note that you want maybe just put on the record that you're also neutral. Why don't y'all come on up and do that? If you don't need to, okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. If you don't mind, I wanted to take a minute to flag an issue that we saw in Section 2 on page 1 of the bill, lines 7 through 13. This is the portion of the bill that says that an inmate has to attach an affidavit stating that the inmate has exhausted all administrative remedies before filing the lawsuit. And this section is sparse in detail on how the process works. So it says, file your affidavit, and then the court shall dismiss without prejudice if there is no affidavit, without really discussing how this comes to the court. Now, typically in a civil case, pleadings issues and dismissal issues are raised by the parties under ORCP 21 and ORCP 54. Involuntary dismissal under 54B would be by motion. And our interpretation looking at this was, well, it must come to the court by way of a motion to dismiss from the defendant. In talking with the Department of Corrections counsel this morning, their legal counsel, he was of the impression that the court would simply dismiss when this came in without an affidavit. And I wanted to point out that if, in fact, that's the intent under the bill, which isn't clear from this section, it would create a pretty large problem for the Oregon Judicial Department. We receive 600,000 new cases per year, 250,000 new civil cases per year, about 100,000 what would generally fall under contract and tort cases per year. And if we have to identify who the parties are to ferret these out and whether an affidavit is with the complaint, that will be a huge workload, because it's not always obvious that the plaintiff is an inmate. It's not always obvious that a public body has been sued. They can sue an employee of a public body. It basically means vetting every complaint that comes in to see if it falls under this. So it becomes the cost-benefit analysis gets upside down, because you're processing so many pieces of paper and teaching staff to look for this in so many cases, when typically in civil actions, that's the party's job. They look and they decide if there's an issue with the pleading, then they bring a motion. So that was the problem that I wanted to raise, and the department has said that they will look at that. Mr. Van Valkenburg needed to talk to some other folks to see what they were thinking on it, and we'll continue the conversation. But as you can see, it would be a tremendous workload issue for the courts. This is not something that counter staff are equipped to do. It requires a certain amount of analysis. You would then have to get a judgment of a dismissal from a judge, because a clerk can't dismiss a case. It would have to come from the judge and set up a whole process that way.
All right, thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Miller, if it were by motion, would that satisfy you?
Yeah.
For problem, so if the Department of Corrections filed a motion?
Yes, that takes care of it all, because then it falls in the standard civil process.
Thanks.
Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And we've had some contact with the Department of Corrections. They've been kind enough to provide us with some of the background for the bill. We have a process internally where we consult with the County Councils Association. They have a legislative committee dealing with legal issues. And although we have not taken a position on this measure yet, County Council's legislative committee recommends that AOC support. Nonetheless, I think the concerns of the Judicial Department would apply equally to Justice of the Peace Courts with regard to small claims issues. So if we could expedite that process in the fashion that's been suggested, I think we'd like that as well.
All right. I need some clarification on that, Paul, because what I heard the bill would do would prohibit someone from going into small claims court and it seems that the court didn't have jurisdiction over the matter, that it would take its action based on it not having jurisdiction. Are you saying that you would want the other side, in this case the Department of Corrections, or the inmate that's being sued in small claims to have to file a motion to have it dismissed?
Mr. Chair, I suspect that the issue with regard to how claims are filed, frankly, how they would come through a jail into a small claims court under justice court jurisdiction, or I suppose equally as well if they came through a Department of Corrections or is sued in justice of the peace courts. If there is an issue on how you identify whether or not the plaintiff in the case has standing, then I think the standing issue, to the extent that I understand the testimony of OJD correctly, would apply in justice courts as well as circuit courts.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here today who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 77? I'm not seeing anyone. What I'm going to do is I want to carry this one over. It is set for tomorrow on our agenda to allow Andrew Meyer, who was already set for travel and will be back in the state tonight, the opportunity if she wants to do live testimony tomorrow. And so we'll reserve some time for tomorrow's on that. And the other thing I do want to, I guess, put on the record is we did receive this other letter of opposition from Janine Woodford and Chase Rivlin, I guess it is. These two individuals appear to be non-Oregon residents. At least I didn't see anything in here that said they were, but they do have dealings with the California Department of Corrections, Washington State Department of Corrections, and the Colorado Department of Corrections. And the chair would be interested to know a little bit more about where their testimony is coming from and who's
ACLU.
Forward. ACLU. All right. That takes care of that.
Can I ask a question?
You may.
Mr. Chair, thank you, of staff, before we end this discussion. I didn't get an opportunity to read Andrea Meyer's written testimony thoroughly, but she does state that under the Federal Prison Litigation Reform Act, that's resulted in additional litigation regarding whether or not the process has been exhausted, the exhaustion requirements have been made, and I just wondered if staff had looked into that or if anybody has any information about that on the federal level, if there's been an increase in costs and expenses in litigating whether or not the exhaustion requirement has been made. Matt?
Chairman of the Committee, Senator Bonamici, I have not looked into it. We can look into it for you.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
That would be. All right. With that, we're going to be adjourning for the day. We will be back here tomorrow at 8:30.
Oh, wow.
And I knew you'd like that.
Keep us on our toes.
Be 8:30, but the two things I want to make sure that we still have on the record is that, first of all, we are going to have a possible work session on Senate Bill 353. We are continuing to leave open for additional public hearing on Senate Bill 77. With that, we're going to go conclude for the day. Members, thank you very much for being here, and we'll see you tomorrow morning at 8:30.